the week of July 18th, 2010, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 63, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Karen Woodward.
And this is Michael Giltz. I'm not sure where I am. I thought I was in New York, but the skyline is bending over backwards like an omelet, and that music is driving me nuts. Can you hear that music?
No. Oh, God.
It's driving me crazy. It keeps playing over and over in my head.
Somebody saw Inception. Michael, you're dreaming. It's okay.
That was very good, Michael. On your end, you're doing all of the audio work yourself, I should add. That was pretty good. I mean, I know you're on assignment and you're outside, and at least you're not on a cell phone as you were last week, but that's not bad.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, color me impressed.
Well, you would have been impressed had we actually managed to get our guests this week. However, all of them had to drop out at the last minute due to legal reasons, and not because they weren't allowed to speak with us legally, but because they were off meeting with lawyers. And one of the people had to do with the Chevron case and the documentary Crude. We will be talking to Joe Berlinger hopefully next week. And of course, there was the FCC ruling on fleeting epithets. That's a word I can't say very well. Epithets.
It's a hard one.
I can actually say the epithets better than I can say the word epithet.
Most people can.
An appeals court decided what was indecent and what isn't indecent and what indecency is, and apparently it's very ill-defined. So we'll be talking a little bit about that during television. Of course, we have to talk about Mel Gibson because everybody's talking about Mel Gibson and his lovely little audio tapes. You know, he could really use your help there, Michael, with all that audio work that you...
Or maybe he just wishes he was dreaming.
Maybe. We had so many Big Deal or Big Whoop news stories during our lightning round. I'm not going to go into them here. Just know that you're in for a huge Big Deal or Big Whoop segment. And we'll finish off with a little inside baseball and talk about who might be replacing Larry King. But as always, we will be going over the weekend's box office. And I have a feeling we're going to be talking about Inception based on Michael's little audio cue there. So Michael Giltz, entertainment journalist extraordinaire, take it away.
All right. Well, I certainly saw Inception this weekend. I don't know about you guys, but that was, of course, the number one movie of the week. It grossed $62.7 million. So that's held up from the predictions. That is, box office profits had a great little piece talking about movies that aren't sequels or based on a book or a franchise or a TV show. Turns out there are only like six films in history that have grossed $60 million or more that were original and new. And Inception is one of them, which makes it really all the more impressive. So that's a $62 million gross. Number two was Despicable Me, the animated film starring Steve Carell. That grossed $32 million for a total of $118 million so far. Number three was the week debut of the run, Nicolas Cage's The Sorcerer's Apprentice, which grossed $17 million over the weekend and $24 million since its opening on Wednesday. It's about $5 million a day, and that's very weak for a movie that cost $150 million. It's going to have a lot of legs, but I doubt it. And number four was the Twilight Saga Eclipse, another $13 million. It's at $264 million in the U.S. and $552 million worldwide. Number five is Toy Story 3, another $11.9 million. That's at $362 million in the U.S., and $629 million worldwide. And then Grown Ups, still grossing almost $10 million, $9.9 million for the Adam Sandler, Chris Rock comedy. That's at $129 million in the U.S., and that's shaping up to be one of Adam Sandler's biggest hits ever. Number seven was The Last Airbender. Apparently some people are still going to it. That grossed $7.7 million, $115 million total in the U.S. Not awful, considering how awful the reviews were. And number 8, 9, and 10, Predators, Night and Day, and The Karate Kid doing sort of cleanup business. Predators is falling pretty fast. It fell 70% this weekend. It's grossed $40 million total. So I don't think we'll be seeing a Predators 4 or 5. I don't know what it is, depending on how you count them.
Well, wasn't this a Predators remake?
It was a reboot. It wasn't quite a remake because in the original, the alien came to U.S., and Arnold and the guys had to deal with it. In this case, the guys are put on the Predator planet and have to deal with it. So it's slightly different.
I think a Predator is after Michael right now. Now I know
there's a little bit more international box office. Shrek Forever After is now at $526 million worldwide. The Prince of Persia is at $325 million worldwide because it made more than two times what it grossed in the U.S. overseas. Iron Man 2 is at $614 million worldwide. It's passed the original by a good $30 million. How to Train Your Dragon is almost at $500 million. And Russell Crowe, whose career looks great compared to Mel Gibson, has only grossed $300 million worldwide for Robin Hood. And that's pretty much at the end of its run.
Well, as you mentioned, Inception, it's the second highest grossing debut ever for a sci-fi movie that was not a sequel. And Avatar, of course, holds the medal for that. It earned $77 million this past December when it opened, and now Inception opens to $62 million. And I don't think it beat out The Dark Knight's opening, did it?
No, no.
And that's, of course, another Chris Nolan film. It's the biggest opening for Leonardo DiCaprio. It just beat out Shutter Island, which opened earlier this year. So he's having a nice little run this year to hit movies.
Did it make more than Titanic?
Opening weekend, absolutely. Titanic didn't, and Titanic's not based on an original idea. That's either a remake of a film or based on historical events, so it doesn't fall under that
doesn't
rubric.
Count. Did you guys both see this movie?
Yes.
Yeah, I saw it too. What did you think?
I saw it. I thought it was really good technically. I loved the score. I loved the way it was edited. I loved everything about it. I thought the acting was interesting. I thought it was a lot of fun. I need to see it again before I can decide whether it's just a puzzle and once you know how it works out, it's over, or whether it actually deepens on a second viewing. That's how I felt. What about you?
You know, I felt the same way about the acting and the score and the art direction. I mean, it was a beautiful movie, but I had to have the movie kind of explained to me afterwards because I felt like I missed some of it.
You weren't alone.
Well, that would have been the part where you fell asleep. That part right there, that's the part you missed.
No, I never fell asleep, actually. Oh, okay. I had some moments where I was sort of bored. The movie I thought was really boring the first 10 minutes when it's supposed to be dragging me in, and instead I was just painfully bored. But it turns out that I actually hadn't missed a thing. And that's what's kind of so interesting about this movie. And it's like what you said, you kind of have to see it again just to see what you missed.
Well, I'm upset because I have friends who are arguing that the movie has a different explanation than I took it at face value. And they're arguing it's not giving anything away to say the whole movie deals with dreams. And so naturally you spend the whole movie wondering what's a dream, what's not a dream. And they're arguing the whole movie's a dream. And I'm like, oh my God, don't say that. I don't want to deal with that. But they're arguing, they're pointing to all these clues. So, but
that's what's so cool about the movie.
Yeah, I mean, it's the last time I've seen something like that was Memento, where the audience after the movie stood around and argued and talked. And this was 3 a.m. I saw it at the Ziegfeld on the Upper West Side, which is the premier screen in Manhattan. And everybody was standing around and people were going, when that was happening.
I love that, though. That, to me, makes a movie really fun.
Now, Memento, of course, is another Chris Nolan movie. And he has been writing these movies with his brother, Jonah Nolan. And he...
Jonathan, isn't it?
Okay, I don't know why I wrote Jonah Nolan in the...
Maybe I'm wrong. I'll check it, but keep going.
Well, Jonathan Nolan is rumored now to be directing Superman or the Superman reboot, which I thought they rebooted just a few years back. And of course, that's another Warner Brothers property. And everybody's saying, well, how does Jonathan Nolan come out of nowhere to direct Superman? What has he directed before that gives him the weight to direct a big DC Comics superhero movie? And I'll tell you what that weight is. It's Christopher Nolan. If you're Warner Brothers, you don't want to piss Christopher Nolan off. And Christopher Nolan is helping produce and structure the Superman story for another film. So I guess Jonathan Nolan will probably wind up with a deal. And there's talk about Zachary Levi playing the lead role.
Nice.
And Zachary Levi, for those of you who don't know, is in Chuck, the television show.
But that's a very modest rumor from a very small website. I wouldn't hold much credence to that. Even the website didn't think that was necessarily true. And I don't know if it's fair to say the studio doesn't want to piss off Christopher Nolan. I'm not going to hand a movie to someone that they don't have faith in, a big franchise like that. They obviously, you know, take him seriously when he says, my brother can do this, and know he'll be shepherding it. But I'm sure that they met with Jonathan and were convinced that he has what it takes. And to be specific, Jonathan did not have a writing credit on Inception, though he has worked on a lot of his other movies, including Memento and The Dark Knight.
And I knew I'd be proven wrong on Inception. For some reason, in the back of my mind, I thought, wait a second, I don't think he wrote Inception. But he did write Memento, along with Christopher Nolan.
But my favorite part of Inception occurred before the movie even began. I don't know if you had this experience, Karen, but I saw the movie at the Ziegfeld at midnight on Thursday. It was the geekiest, most in-tune crowd you could ask for. These people were hungry to see the movie. The lights go down and a trailer begins for another movie. And It's like people going to an office building in New York, it looks like, and the vision is, the film is flipped upside down. You're not sure what you're watching. Is it a heist film? Is it a horror film? Suddenly you see five different people all get on an elevator, and it seems like maybe there's a creature there attacking them, and then the security cameras are going, and security and guards and cops are rushing in with their gun. You don't know what's going on. And they're telling you that it's building and building and building. And then it says it's a new horror film. And it says from the mind, just a credit flashes on the screen from the mind of M. Night Shyamalan.
Oh,
and
no.
The entire crowd, which was completely quiet up to this point, just watching the trailer, burst out laughing.
Oh.
Burst out laughing. I am not exaggerating. I couldn't believe it. I thought, oh my God, I've never seen anything like it. And in fact,
no.
Somebody else videotaped the audience reaction at another screening, and it's online. If you go to Showbiz Sandbox, our channel on YouTube, you'll find that 40-second clip of people bursting out laughing when they unsuspectingly see the name of M. Night Shyamalan appear as a credit on a film. So the movie's called Devil. It comes out in the fall or something. But God help M. Night Shyamalan. I've never seen anything like that.
But, you know, speaking of reactions, how did your audience react after the final scene of the movie?
They laughed. They had a pleasant. They felt tweaked and played with, and they liked it.
Mine laughed and cheered, but a friend of mine saw it in the Valley, and her audience groaned. They were mad.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I have to see it again because I have arguments about people. What exactly happened in that last scene?
I loved Joe Morgenstern's review of the film. The headline was "Inception: To Dream." Perchance to sleep. And he just hated the film.
Really?
Yeah, he did not like the film at all. And so I don't know. I thought it was a funny headline for that.
It's a great headline.
Yeah.
But I would say no matter what, you have to see it. And you certainly want to see it on a big screen. I can easily see resisting it or taking issues with it. But it's well, very well made. It's intelligent. And it's certainly worth seeing.
Well, there's some question in Hollywood whether Mel Gibson's next movie you'd want to see. And that was my way of moving us on to the movie news of the week, which
is... That was a segue. You're not supposed to do a segue.
I know. We said we wouldn't do segues anymore because we've gotten a lot of emails about them, but every once in a while we can throw a segue in, no?
Sure.
Okay. It's a resounding, unanimous yes. Okay, well, everybody's talking about these Mel Gibson audio tapes, and they're not audio tapes. I don't know why people keep referring to them as audio tapes, but they are recordings of Mel Gibson as a raving lunatic. He is screaming and yelling at his former girlfriend and mother of his youngest child. And have either of you heard these recordings?
Oh, yeah.
And what do you
I have not. I don't want those voices in my head. I don't want to hear it.
Oh, my goodness. Trust me, you don't want to listen to them because they are incredibly disturbing, in my opinion. And
it's very upsetting.
Oh, well, where can you find them?
Anywhere, honestly. Just do a Google search for it. Sperling, what do you mean they're not audio tapes? I mean, they're certainly not video.
No, meaning that they're not actually taped. I'm sure it's an MP3 of some kind. They were digitally recorded, no doubt.
I think she recorded them on her cell phone or something. But yeah, and there have been several that have come out, and it's just now the backlash is starting, and people are starting to wonder whether they were tampered with. But I have a feeling they weren't, or if they were, not by much, because he's actually had a reputation for being like this for quite some time.
Oh,
and this is not unusual. I mean, I've heard comments from him off the record, from interviews that he did with reporters that were just as hateful, not about his girlfriends or wives, but the nasty, ugly things he said, and he's, you know, it's not news in that sense.
You know, Karen, did you listen to the 8-minute version?
I don't know if it was the 8-minute version. I didn't listen to the whole 8 minutes because you do get sort of the gist after about 4.
And he is just, I mean, screaming, and he is almost, you know, I want to say homicidal, but then he would have had to have killed somebody. But he just comes off as incredibly mentally disturbed.
It definitely comes under the you can't make this stuff up. Yeah.
And he's panting. I mean, he seems like he's out of breath. It almost seems as if he is on something, whether it be alcohol or drugs. I do not know. And
isn't it just the natural sound of somebody who's in a bitter, nasty fight with someone? I mean, people scream and yell.
It could be. My first thought was the same thing, though.
Yeah.
Was that he had to have been on drugs or something. Because it's like... There's also a mashup that you can pretty easily find between the Christian Bale rant and this one.
Oh, God.
And, But it's really funny. But you can tell the difference in a way, you know, because Christian Bale's just clearly is someone who's just losing his temper. But Mel Gibson sounds like he is on something because it's like it's beyond losing his
My temper. Favorite description of this was somebody who described the Dickensian nature of it because it's like a serial where every few days a new edition comes out. You find out, what has he said today?
Well, yeah, and I have to – I mean, you asked where you could hear them. Radar Online is where this story first broke and where the audio can be found. And after I listened to it, I actually felt bad. I felt bad that I had listened to it. I felt bad that I had visited the website. I felt bad that I was contributing, frankly, to this kind of gossip mongering and never went back to the website to look at any of the other additions that were added throughout the week. I mean, I think Radar Online is really milking this. And as Patrick Goldstein said, he is a columnist for the Los Angeles Times, he said the story jumped the shark when people started writing about how the audio had been tampered with. You know, I think David Brooks probably put it best in his New York Times column. He diagnosed Gibson as a narcissist. Now, should I read this, what he wrote?
No, it's too long.
No, it's long.
And David Brooks is a putz. But we link to it. And Frank Rich has a nice column, too, about Mel Gibson and the religious right, which is worth looking up in the New York Times as well. But like you say, it is sort of telling about Radar. Radar was originally a print magazine, and Mary Rashan was the guiding hand behind that, a very talented editor and person in magazine industry, still very respected, and he launched that magazine, and it was a very interesting, innovative thing, and it struggled financially from the get-go. It was a hard time to launch a magazine. It went print and online print. Now it's just online only, and now it's more like TMZ is all it's known for. It's very sad to see a site that began as really good, serious journalism reduced to that. Not that the tapes aren't worthy of printing and or presenting, but
yeah,
that's known for. It's kind of a bummer.
I'm going to say something here, but Sperling, what you said about feeling guilty that you were, you know, contributing to the gossip mongering. I mean, has it gotten out of hand? Yeah. And I have not gone and listened to all five. I've only listened to a portion of one and I got the gist. But I think this kind of thing really needs to be brought to light. Yeah, I do.
I mean, really, because when you think about it, as I was listening to the 8-minute version of one of these clips, I thought to myself, you know, this is a slanted conversation. Obviously, Mel Gibson is incredibly upset, if not mentally unbalanced, in this particular moment in his life. And the person recording him knows it's being recorded and is very, very quiet. And of course, comes off looking much better.
But that's neither here nor there.
The fact that he didn't know he was being recorded doesn't
matter.
Excuse.
The fact is, too, is that this kind of thing happens all the time in the United States and all kinds of countries, and people don't pay any attention to it.
Well, now we're paying too much attention to it.
But you know, if they can start a dialogue about this kind of abuse, then I say let's go for it.
Well, as Patrick Goldstein points out, when David Brooks, who, you know, you describe as a putz, Michael, but he really does nail what narcissism is quite well. And Patrick Goldstein, in commenting on David Brooks' New York Times column, said that, you know, look, Hollywood is filled with narcissists, people that...
Of course.
Yeah, that, you know, it's me first and me only, and it's my world, you just happen to live in it. And if you go up against me, you will be met with overwhelming force in a way that is not, that doesn't balance out. Really,
right. Well, the only other thing I'll say is that we linked to an article in the Daily Beast about the movie The Beaver, which is Jodie Foster's comeback film as a director, not comeback, but her decision to return to filmmaking, I should say, as a director and an actress, playing the wife of Mel Gibson, his character, who is a toy company executive who carries around a hand puppet of a beaver that talks to people all the time. It's this weird, quirky, strange little movie, and it's now, of course. You know, they don't know what to do. How long do they wait before they release it? This columnist in The Sexy Beast, Kara Kutrazula, says it's one of the most anticipated films of the year.
The Daily Beast.
She says it's one of the most anticipated films of the year, and we may never see it. And I disagree with both of them. It's not the most anticipated film of the year, and I'm sure we will see it someday. They just need to wait until the time is right again.
It's a marketer's nightmare, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
They gotta wait.
Yeah, it is a marketer's nightmare.
And certainly see it.
I think we probably will see it. I think it's being described as a dark comedy in the key of Little Miss Sunshine. And I just feel bad for Jodie Foster, who was going to direct, I think it was Flora Plum, and it was going to star Russell Crowe.
Right.
And he injured his shoulder, so that film fell apart. And now she finally directs a film, and it's falling apart after it's done because, you know, of what the star did in his private life.
Well, I like Jodie Foster. I like that she, you know, is nice to people who she's worked with, who I assume treated her well. But, you know, her and Whoopi Goldberg, it's like, how much does this guy have to do before you say, yeah, you know, I know you, but actually what you're doing is kind of despicable, and I don't want to be that associated with you anymore. You know, there's a thing between not abandoning someone you know and supporting them and casting them in movies and acting like they're fine. You know, at some point, the things this guy says, you got to say, hey, it matters.
Well, you know, what he said when played on television was kind of bleeped out. It was a series of bleeps. And that's because, of course, you can't say certain words on television. And Karen, would you like to say all of those words?
Oh, you know I do.
Okay, yes. Yeah, so, but that was my poor segue. This is, again, another poor segue into our television news of the week, which came as we were recording last week's episode. And it was about the Federal Communications Commission and a ruling that came down against them over indecency. And an appeals court struck down the FCC's policy on indecency, I guess it was on Tuesday, saying that regulations barring the use of quote-unquote fleeting expletives on radio and television violated the First Amendment because they were vague and could inhibit free speech. And what they mean by that it was kind of vague is that they never really defined what indecency was.
Well, it's a hard thing to describe. It's like pornography. You just know it when you see it.
And it changes from community to community. And so therefore, when you're talking about a major network, what standard applies? The standard of Peoria, Illinois, or the standard of, you know, L.A.? It's very different, obviously.
Do you remember how this all started?
Janet Jackson,
that's right. Her little wardrobe malfunction during the Super Bowl back in 2004, which Fox was fined for. So Fox, CBS, and other broadcasters decided to, I guess, go up against the FCC, and it went to, you know, from the district court to the appeals court. And now some are saying, I guess legal analysts are saying, that this will go all the way to the Supreme Court.
Yeah, I think this ruling is good. I mean, the FCC went overboard in the other direction. If you had an award show and they were having to parse whether you used the F word as an adjective or a noun, you know, it was just
bizarre.
You know, yeah, it was silly. But on the other hand, it's not that big a deal to have a 5-second delay and bleep out curse words unless you decide you want to use them. But it was the FCC ruling was so broad, PBS stations were afraid to air the Ken Burns documentary about World War II because people cursed in there talking about their experiences in battle. And, you know, like some kid is going to watch that in order to hear a curse word. So, you know, they went way too overboard. And I think it's a good ruling. But I also think people should be able to watch TV. And, you know, if you're putting on the Academy Awards, you don't expect somebody to start cursing in the middle of it, you know, in the 7 p.m. hour.
You know, I saw The Fantastic Mr. Fox again over the weekend, and I love the way they use profanity in that film. They don't use it. They just say, what the cuss word is so-and-so doing?
Yeah, it's very cute.
The Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit in New York City, in their decision, said, quote, that the policy creates a chilling effect that goes far beyond the fleeting expletives at issue here, because it left broadcasters without a reliable guide to what the commission would find offensive. So what they're saying is, look, FCC, we're not stripping you of your power here. You just have to define what indecency is. And once you define it, then the broadcasters can at least turn to the definition and know what is allowed and what is not allowed.
How entertaining would it be to be the person who has to define that?
Yeah, it's impossible. You know, and I just think overall families should be able to turn on the TV and be able to find some programming on major networks that isn't filled with sexually suggestive language or curse words. But there are so many options out there that, you know, if you know where to go and what to watch if you don't want to hear it. So, you know, don't put on the BET Awards at 10 p.m. You know.
Or maybe we should just stop being such a prudish society.
Well, I was trying not to be too East Coast, West Coast and acknowledge the heartland for a minute.
Well, you know, if it does go to the Supreme Court, scholars are warning that the FCC will have to be careful, because if the court decides to reverse the longstanding precedents that subject broadcast content to indecency standards, then the FCC will have another battle on its hands and will really be stripped of its power. The FCC has not had a very good year, has it? First, they had the, the broadband initiative struck down, and then they were told that net neutrality was not their business, and now they have this ruling. They're not doing too well.
Well, it is a good year because this is a case held over from the Bush era, and one assumes that the Obama administration and the FCC for them would be a little more understanding of the, that you can't nanny police the entire country when it comes to television.
Moving on.
And maybe we should move on to music. What do you think?
Music.
How's that for a segue? Was that a good segue?
Love that as a segue.
Yeah. You know, by the way, they're not really segues when you point them out. FYI.
Sure they are.
Really? Okay. Well, there was a story in several outlets, but the one we linked to is from hitfix.com about the 2010 best-selling album list so far. Who do you think is on top?
According to the show notes, it looks like it is Lady Antebellum.
You know, that would be considered cheating.
I thought it was a trick question.
No.
That surprises me.
Yes, it is Lady Antebellum. Need You Now is the name of the album, and it sold 2.35 million copies, which is a lot of copies, a lot of units, a lot of...
In this day and age,
yeah. Exactly.
It's a big hit because it has a massive hit single. It's a country band, but it also plays adult contemporary. So they're reaching a lot of people and a lot of adults who are going to be more likely to buy CDs.
Did you just actually use a profane word there? Because yeah, I thought somebody might be trying to... Justin Bieber is in second place with his album My World 2.0. 1.39 million copies of that have sold, more than Sade's Soldier of Love, which has sold 1.21 million copies and is in third place. Lady Gaga's The Fame has sold 1.15 million copies. Although, wasn't that an album that was released last year?
Well, this is sales during this year, so that's even more impressive because obviously it sold a million or so copies last year.
Right, and now Eminem, whose album only came out, I believe, in either early July or June, his album Recovery comes in fifth place, if I'm counting correctly. Usher, Raymond versus Raymond, 898,000 copies of that have sold. And then your favorite group, Michael.
Tonight's gonna be a good night.
And for them, it's 853,000 copies of The END in seventh place. But again, that album was released last year, so I don't...
That's really impressive, yeah.
Yeah. Justin Bieber is in here twice, in ninth place as well. His album, My World, has sold 710,000 copies this year. So obviously it sold more in previous years. And Drake rounds out the top 10 with Thank Me Later, 709,000 copies.
And he's, of course, an actor from Degrassi, The Next Generation, a Canadian show that's been on for years and years and years. And he's just totally renamed and reworked himself into this massive hip-hop star. I mean, he has a huge bunch of heavy hitters on his album. And people don't even mention the fact that he was on Degrassi. It's very funny. He's just, like, completely remade himself.
I don't know about that. I've certainly read that he has been, and he was an actor first, and his acting credits in almost every story that I read about him.
Yeah, but it's just that nobody in the United States knows what Degrassi is.
I write about it all the time.
Well, I do too, but we work in the business.
And Eminem, I should correct myself. Recovery, his album Recovery, was sold in Walmart. They did have a clean edition out, so that 1.09 million copies did include copies of CDs sold at Walmart, which I didn't think was the case.
Now, are you correcting yourself from a previous episode?
I am.
Okay, just wondering. Okay. Michael, you have a bunch of albums that you think are the best, or at least your favorite albums of the year so far, and unlike this other group that only has 10 albums in it, you have about 300 or 400, I believe.
Yeah. Well, you know, people always say, oh, there's no good music. There's so much good music out there. It's a little harder to find. You're not going to see videos on MTV. There's fewer places to review music, but there's a lot of great music out there.
Michael, we wouldn't see videos on MTV anyway.
Right, exactly. I mean, right, I'm saying MTV doesn't play videos. Radio is dead. You know, there's no way to hear about it. You've just got to, like, you've got to actively and aggressively seek out the music, but there's a lot of great music out there. Peter Wolf from the J. Geils Band, you probably remember them from Centerfold. That was their massive hit. He's just an unbelievably talented guy. His new album, Midnight Souvenirs, is just great. It's like a soul pop album. It is so much fun. Ali Farkar Touré and Toumani Diabaté. This is one of the best world music albums of the year. Ali Farkar Touré died last year, and as he was dying, he recorded this second duets album with Toumani Diabaté. These are two huge
while
African
he was
artist.
Dying. Wow, it's just a bunch of coughs.
No. I mean, and it is and a great album, by the way. I've heard the album. It's very, very good.
It's beautiful. It's beautiful. One of the most. It's just a lovely album. It's the sort of album that cafes and other places will play, and you'll hear it, and you won't know what it is, and you'll ask about it, and you'll buy it because it's just a lovely, wonderful album. Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings. She's a Brooklyn born soul singer. She's in her 40s or 50s. She's awesomely talented. Her band, the Dap Kings, played on Amy Winehouse's album and helped that album become a huge, massive hit. She has a new album out called I Learned the Hard Way, which is awesome.
That is a great album. Each song, one after the other, are just phenomenal.
It's just a soul gem. Eminem's album is really good. It's much better than Relapse. Tom Jones has an album coming out in a few weeks called Praise and Blame, which is overseen by Rick Rubin, who saw career resurgences, of course, for Johnny Cash and Neil Diamond. This is the best album of Tom Jones's career.
You know, you want to hear a little interesting tidbit about Rick Rubin?
Uh-huh.
He worked at my dormitory at New York University when I was a student there.
You should have worked with him.
Yeah, you know what? He was kind of, he had the big beard back then, too, and he was managing the Beastie Boys' career at the time.
Was he a student?
He was a student, and he was
an
RA.
Yeah, that's how he got started, in his dorm room.
Yeah, with the Beastie Boys, who were also students at NYU, along with Adam Sandler, believe it or not. Apparently, I am the least successful graduate of NYU.
Aww.
And we have a lot of other music listed here. You can go look on our show notes online. Johnny Cash, Midlake, this great Midwestern band, this band from Texas, John Mellencamp's box set, Sade, Trombone Shorty, who's this jazz artist who's on the HBO series Tremé, Gorillaz, Sade, Marina and the Diamonds, a very fun New York band. Paul Weller, the UK artist, Charlie Hayden and Keith Jarrett, another lovely, lovely duets album called Jasmine. And of course, I would never leave off the list, MGMT, whose new album, Congratulations, is certainly one of the best reviewed albums of the year. So go online and you can see a list. And if you like the genre that the music is, check it out because I think you'll like the album.
Well, Marina and the Diamonds, it has one of the best album names this year. Family Jewels is their album. And it's a great album, too. Gorillaz, the Plastic Beach album is great. Johnny Cash, how many songs does this guy have saved up? Because he's been releasing songs since, I think, 2003 when he passed away. He's got like six albums since then. Midlake, again, great band. But now I wonder, what do you think about Lil Wayne releasing an album from prison?
I love the headline on this item in the New York Times. It says his album could be released before Lil Wayne is.
That's true, yes.
His EP, I should say.
His manager, Cortez Bryant, who runs Lil Wayne's Young Money record label and is a co-manager of the jailed rapper, told Vibe that he will, quote-unquote, drop an EP of the artist's work on September 27th. On September 28th, he will pick it up.
Okay.
I need a sound effect for a rim shot, I think, for all my corny jokes.
That's not a bad idea.
Yeah.
Michael, can you get on that?
Yeah, you seem to be quite good with the sound effects. I'm Not a Human Being is going to be the name of the EP, which I think some people might agree with.
People love Lil Wayne. What are you saying?
No, I'm just kidding. Of course, you might recall that back in March of this year, Wayne was sentenced to a year on Rikers Island in New York for attempted possession of a weapon after a gun was found on his tour bus in 2007, but he could be out for good behavior round about September or October, right when this album is going to be dropped.
It's funny because I was actually at Yankee Stadium yesterday watching a game, and Vincent, the friend sitting next to me, who was big in the music industry and had oversaw some acts and had some big hits on singles, on 12 inches, he was going off how he couldn't stand Lil Wayne. Can't stand him.
You know, he might be in jail, but I think it was the New York Times. Actually, everybody ran this story because Lil Wayne actually posted something on his blog, which had to have been posted by Cortez Bryant, his manager, about what he does every day in prison. He says,
"This is a joke, right?"
One would hope so. He says,
"In Rikers, yeah,
Rikers Island." He quote wakes up around 11 a.m., has some coffee, call my kids and my wonderful mother. I then shower up, read fan mail, have lunch, back on the phone, read a book or write some thoughts down, have dinner, phone, push-ups. Then I listen to ESPN on the radio, read the Bible, then sleep. That's my day.
What's the accent, Sperling?
I don't know. That was my, let's read a letter from prison accent.
Rikers Island is one of the toughest prisons there is. He's not, this is a joke, right? This has to be a joke.
No idea.
I have no idea, but I can't imagine that anybody's going to be messing with Lil Wayne in prison.
Well, I don't know. I mean, as soon as I read he was in Rikers, I was like, I hope he doesn't, you know, bend over.
Yikes.
Well, you can get points by picking on a celebrity, but I'm sure he's safe and they're keeping him safe. But waking up around 11 seems impossible in a prison.
I know.
But, the reason I think this article is interesting is because it you know, the idea of him putting out this EP before the album comes out later in the year, and they might just release it digitally, it sort of shows how, like, that idea of artists from the 80s and 90s, where you would wait 3 or 5 years and release a big blockbuster album, that is so dead. People release singles now. They release EPs online. I'm sure Lil Wayne's been on some mixtapes. Then he'll have an album out. You know, it's just a constant flow of music. It's just a whole new world, very different from the way it was 10 or 20 years ago.
Well, because if they do it the old-fashioned way, it's going to get out anyway, so...
That's right. Plus, if you look at the best-selling album of the year, has sold 2 million copies. That's chicken feed compared to what they were doing, you know, 10 years ago.
So what you're saying, Karen, is that if they record an entire album and go through the whole release process with a tour and...
That would be a big deal.
Well, okay, I see you're trying to transition us into Big Deal or Big Whoop.
Oh, I thought I was helping you.
Oh, okay. No, but I was going to ask. You're saying that it would get out, what, on BitTorrent and it would be pirated?
Yeah.
Okay, so yeah, and you know the issue really is they need to figure out a way to make money, and something we're not really going to discuss or talk about in it at any length or in depth this week is the fact that all of these tours for all of these different acts, including the Eagles even, had to cancel 2 shows. Limp Bizkit canceled 20 some odd shows. They're all canceling shows.
Yeah, but does anybody care about Limp Bizkit?
Well, that's part of the problem. And there's this question as to why is concert revenue down 15%? It's really affecting Live Nation, the group that bought Ticketmaster. So now they're one big giant group and they bought Ticketmaster, and now concert tickets are on the decline.
I'm surprised it's only down 15%. And if U2 hadn't had backed out of the tour because of Bono's bad back, and Simon and Garfunkel had toured, which they couldn't do because Art's voice went, we wouldn't even be down that much. We'd be down like 3 or 5%, and we wouldn't even be having this discussion. It should be down a lot more, and it's because it's discretionary income. It's really easy to say, you know what, I think I'll skip that $300 ticket to the Eagles. I saw them 3 or 4 years ago.
Certainly the music industry thinks that this declining concert revenue is a big deal. How's that, Karen, for a nice
There
little,
you go.
There you go. Okay.
Hey, Karen, I'm with you. I thought he was segueing into that, too. I was
totally did. I thought I was
you.
Helping.
Well, that does bring us to Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly lightning round segment where we discuss the top entertainment news stories of the week and whether they are a big deal or if anyone should care about them. Our first story of the week, just who exactly is doing the stealing here? The RIAA has been aggressively pursuing people who download and or post music they don't have the rights to, which, by the way, is most people who post music on the internet, they don't have the rights to it. Most of the cases that make the news are not hardcore pirates, but average Joes who snuck a peek at the new Eminem CD. Now we find out the RIAA paid at least some lawyer $17.5 million last year, but only recovered $391,000. So tell us again, who is getting ripped off here? Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
This is a big deal, and clearly I should have gone to law school.
Michael?
I think it's a big deal, but I think that the article is a little confused. If they're paying $17 million to threaten people who piracy, they might be squashing a lot more activity than the actual $391,000 they recover. So it's sort of a preemptive strike. You know you're going to get everything thrown at you. If you do piracy, you may be less likely to do it. So that's $17 million, but you're talking about billions of dollars in piracy, so it's not necessarily money poorly spent.
You're saying there's some collateral benefits.
Absolutely, yeah. You know you're going to get the hammer dropped on you. That might scare you out of doing it casually.
And we should say that the RIAA is the Recording Industry Association of America, I believe is what that stands for. William Morris Endeavor may want to phone a friend. Celador, the company behind the smash hit game show format Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, successfully sued ABC for $269 million. It says it was cheated out of the profits from the show. Of course, we talked a little bit about this in last week's episode. We'll talk about it again in our listener email. Now, Celador has a new target in its sights, William Morris Endeavor, whose earlier incarnation brokered the deal for them. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, this is a huge deal, and I always love it when people sue their agencies. They don't have a chance in hell of winning, I would think, but...
Who knows? Michael?
I think it's a big deal, too. When you rip people off, they should be able to sue. ABC, I think ABC did rip them off, And if William Morris didn't do a good job brokering the deal, then they deserve to pay.
Is John Travolta ready to work for Pixar? Late superstar Paul Newman was a huge fan of auto racing, and so was a natural choice to voice a major character in the Pixar film Cars, which has a sequel out next summer. Now, Pixar, the company that can do no wrong at the box office, or with critics, is readying a spin-off of sorts called Airplanes. Travolta is a fanatic about flying, with a landing strip at one of his homes and a jumbo jet at his disposal. So he might just get a phone call. Michael, is this movie Airplane a big deal or a big whoop? I guess it's Airplanes, I should say.
You got to say Airplanes or you're going to get pictures of Leslie Nielsen in your head. I think it's a big deal because it shows Pixar really breaking away from its earlier stance about no sequels and spinoffs. I mean, we've got Monsters, Inc. 2. We've got a third Toy Story. We've got Cars 2 and now a spinoff Airplanes. This is a real sea change for them.
Karen?
Big whoop. Cartoon, Travolta getting a job, blah, blah, blah.
I don't know why I bother. I totally forgot. Hulu, the online site for TV fanatics, launched Hulu Plus Too Much Hoopla. For $10 a month, you can get access to an entire season of the TV shows they have available, rather than just the last four episodes. You can watch them on mobile devices like the iPad, and you get them in high def. In an LA Times article, Hulu execs say they have been overwhelmed by demand. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal if it's true that they've been overwhelmed by demand.
Michael?
You know, I have a similar take as Karen. I think it's a big deal, but I think they're trying to cover up not being prepared for the demand that they had. You know, I think they're trying to say, well, why are we not able to process the people who signed up for this? Oh, it's because there's so many of them. I think they're trying to put a good spin on them not having the infrastructure ready. So this is a big deal because it could be a sign of them not ready for prime time.
Well, Michael, how's the water, by the way? It sounds like you're sailing.
Yeah, it was very windy here for a moment.
Your mission, if you decide to accept it, is to convince people that Tom Cruise will be starring in Mission Impossible 4. That shouldn't be hard to do. After all, Cruise starred in Mission Impossibles 1 through 3, and they've been the only franchise of his career. But thanks to off-screen antics and the underperformance of Night and Day at the U.S. box office, it's news that Cruise is confirmed for the lead. So, Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop? And by the way, this podcast will self-destruct in 5 seconds.
I say it's a big whoop because I never doubted he would star in it.
I'm sorry. I think this is a big deal because if it's true, and I don't think the movie will do well, and I bet you anything, they'll get some young buck who will step in and, you know, with his son or something, you know, Bo Hunt or something. And
oh, the kid from The Kids Are All Right that you couldn't believe was going to be in Spider-Man.
Yeah, that guy. Garfield? Andrew Garfield?
No, not Andrew Garfield. He's good. He is in Spider-Man.
Josh Hutcherson? No, Andrew Garfield's not.
Oh my God.
And the dog agrees.
The dog agrees. Baby, baby, baby. When Justin Bieber was 13, he had his first love. Now that he's 16, Bieber has the most watched YouTube video of all time. The video? Baby. Which has been going mano a mano with Lady Gaga's Bad Romance for the number one slot of all time, at least on YouTube, with more than 245 million views. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
That he has a most watched YouTube? Big deal. That's how he got started.
Michael?
I think it's a big deal. You know, it shows how people's viewing habits have changed. You don't go to MTV anymore, you go to YouTube. 245 million views? That's unbelievable. For one video, that's insane. But also, obviously, Sperling, your children are not old enough to listen to Justin Bieber, or you know that you should have gone, baby, 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 and not what you did, which is sort of a hip-hop thing.
Oh, jeez, I can't win for losing on this episode. If Mark Ruffalo can handle two controlling lesbian moms and two needy teens, surely some evil villains won't be any trouble. The star of The Kids Are All Right is reportedly about to sign on as the Hulk for the upcoming Marvel movie, The Avengers. Meanwhile, Ed Norton, who got publicly dumped from the project by Marvel, which basically called him impossible to work with, will have to settle for his next film, Stone, co-starring Robert De Niro. How many times will Ruffalo have to hear the line, "You wouldn't like me when I'm angry," before he goes crazy? And Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal for Mark Ruffalo because he's never had a payday, and this could lead to one. So, and he's a great actor, so I'm happy for him. And the kid in The Kids Are All Right is called Josh Hutcherson. I just remembered.
Karen?
This is a gigantic deal. First of all, I think Mark Ruffalo is a better choice for the Hulk anyway. But it's a gigantic deal for him, and it just, oh, God, makes Ed Norton look so bad. Not that I think it'll affect his career, but...
Well, you know, last week you said that you were surprised that Marvel and I guess it was Disney or who came out and, well, Marvel came out and said, no, we're not doing this Hulk movie with Ed Norton. He's just too difficult to work with. And you were surprised at that because you thought, well, you know, it's one thing to dump the actor, but why do you have to bash him on the way out the door? And his agent was fuming over that.
Oh, I think I actually was in favor of bashing him on the way out the door.
No, I was the one who was upset. I was the one who thought it was unprofessional and not cool. It's like, there's no point in doing that. Why diss somebody publicly? There's just no reason for that. There's no advantage to doing that. It's just petty, and it's not good business practice long term.
John Edwards may not have made it to the White House, but he is headed to the big screen. Aaron Sorkin, the talent behind Emmy-winning smash series The West Wing, has optioned The Politician, a book about Edwards, and is turning it into a movie. Will the movie focus on his passionate work as a lawyer fighting for the little guy against evil corporations? Will it focus on his brilliant career, taking Edwards all the way to the vice presidential nomination alongside Al Gore? Actually, it wasn't Al Gore. It was John Kerry, if I'm not mistaken.
It was Kerry, yeah.
Yeah. Or perhaps, just perhaps, will it deal with his implosion during a run for president after it came out Edwards cheated on his cancer-stricken wife with a hussy? We wonder. But more importantly, Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
You know, the real-life scandal was a bigger deal. This is really just a matter of casting and, you know, and a movie being made, which is not a big deal at all.
Michael?
I agree. I think it's a big whoop. I think it's a dull, uninteresting project to choose.
Are you nuts? I would totally see this movie.
It seems more like a TV movie to me.
Karen, Michael, I would have words with thee. The gods of Hollywood have taken the measurement of 3D and declared that Thor and Captain America will be in 3D. For Odin, for Asgard, and for the fans, have at thee. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop? Never mind.
Are you really asking me this?
Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal that they were so defensive about it because both of them had the directors out in front saying, yes, we're doing it in 3D and a lot of it has sucked, but we're going to do it right. So I find that very interesting. They're getting a little defensive about wanting to tack on $3 to every movie that they release.
Well, Kenneth Branagh is the filmmaker behind Thor, and he says, you know, that he came to feel that in their case, 3D, quote, could be a very good friend of the story and character for a different kind of experience. But he wasn't a big fan of it initially. Joe Johnston is going to be directing Captain America, and he says, quote, I think it tends to be overused and can be a little bit gimmicky, and that's what he says about 3D. He goes on to call it, when it's done bad, it can make you car sick.
Just what you want to hear from a summer movie.
We told you not to worry. We promised you that, of course, there would be another James Bond film. And now longtime Bond producer Michael G. Wilson has stated the obvious and confirmed not only will there be a new James Bond film, but it will happen, quote-unquote, soon. By the way, you can take that sentence as a given now and forever. There will always be a new Bond film in the works, and you can always look forward to one every 3 to 5, or at the most, 10 years. And so can your children, and so can your children's children, and your children's grandchildren. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop because they're stating the obvious.
Karen?
Big whoop for the same reason.
Well then, I'll move on. If you've got a library of hardcovers and paperbacks, be prepared to explain to your grandchildren exactly what they are, because a physical copy of a novel may become a thing of the past. Amazon reported that during the last 3 months, sales of ebooks outpaced physical books 143-100. That is, for every 100 actual books sold, they sold 143 ebooks. Last month, the pace increased to 180 ebooks for every physical copy. Amazon, of course, is one of the largest booksellers in the country. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
This is a big deal.
Michael?
It sure is. It is a sea change in buying. That is just unbelievable.
That concludes our big deal or big whoop segment for this week. We should move on to listener email. We received an email from Richard Swordstrom out of New York. He writes, your interview with Edward Epstein on episode 62 presented a really good overview of how accounting is done on Hollywood for film productions. Thank you, Richard, for saying that. He goes on to say, during the interview, you also mentioned two cases which reached their conclusions recently. Selador's lawsuit over Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, which we talked about earlier in this episode, and Don Johnson's suit over Nash Bridges. What's interesting about these two cases is that they are for older television shows. These days, contracts for television productions include an arbitration clause which prevents contract players from suing the production company or a network for any profit participation. As well, These more recent contracts include a limit to punitive damages. So what does this all mean? A lot of cases you'll hear about, which are similar to Celador's and Don Johnson's, will actually be for much older films and television shows which did not include these clauses in their contracts by default. Keep up the good work on the show. Sincerely, Richard.
Oh, it's nice.
Yeah, and I should say that really, it's not that they can't sue for profit participation, which they can't because of these clauses, or that they won't get any. They will get profit participation if it's in their contract. But they can't then go around afterwards and say, well, you know, we're going to sue you because you say the film lost money.
Well, you can always sue someone if they do illegal illegal things. They can't claim, you know, that you deserve $4 when you deserve $400,000. You know, arbitration just means instead of going through legal terms, you go through an arbitrator, which you both agree on. But it's interesting. Celador certainly would not have had that sort of clause in its contract. That would be a very different thing. But always important to remember, you can't give away your basic rights. A lot of companies will make you sign clauses that say, oh, I can never say a single word about anything that happens here, and oh, I can never sue you for anything, and oh, I give up the right to do this and that. You can't give up your basic rights to sue and be sued. So,
well, right, know. But in this case, instead of suing, you'd have to go to an arbitrator. And the reason that the studios and networks prefer to go to an arbitrator is there's no emotion in it. The arbitrator is usually somebody who knows law and is schooled in constitutional law and in
well, there's no
law.
Emotion if you go to a judge, a trial by judge.
Well, no, a jury did settle the Celador lawsuit.
Right, so. But you can also be judged by, have a trial with a judge ruling.
That's true, too.
Yeah. They like arbitrators because they think they can limit it more and make it save money and screw you and limit your upside.
Are you typing your lawsuit as we speak?
But that was nice, Richard. That's very interesting, the stuff he wrote. And that's a good point that a lot of older shows might get reviewed again and again, especially as they come out on DVD.
Yes, and thank you, Richard, for your email. You sent it to dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Send in your emails, and we can read them on future episodes. That brings us to Inside Baseball, our segment where we discuss the stories that only Hollywood might care about. And in this case, it's a story that people outside Hollywood probably care about. It's about Larry King, who will be the next Larry King. Wait a second. Isn't Larry King still Larry King? Yes, but CNN needs a new host for their once signature 9 o'clock hour. That new host is UK interviewer Piers Morgan, best known in the US for being a judge on America's Got Talent. Morgan will continue with that show, plus get paid $6 million or more for taking over King's slot. Meanwhile, Ryan Seacrest, King's first choice for his replacement, will have to console himself with the 17 other jobs he's presently holding down. Now, why is this part of our Inside Baseball segment? Because it reveals a lot about what CNN hopes to do in the future. Michael, what do you think? I know you have specific thoughts on this. What do you think it means?
Well, I don't think it bodes well for CNN. I'm glad they're not trying to turn themselves into Fox News, as they've been trying to do for a while. Clearly sticking with an interviewer at 9 o'clock shows that they're not caving into that. But I don't think they can do business as usual either. This sort of idea that you can spend the 9 o'clock hour and just have a chat show, I think it's outmoded and outdated, and they're crazy to try and duplicate it. Piers Morgan is a talented interviewer. He's been doing it in the UK for a while, but you know, he's going to draw people to 9 o'clock? It just seems CNN is lost and doesn't know what to do. They're losing to MSNBC. They're in third place, which is unbelievable to me. Fox is way, way ahead of them, and this is not the solution to their problem.
Yeah, I agree. I thought this was a really curious choice. Taking somebody from a reality show whose background is tabloid journalism, I just think it was a really odd choice. I'm not sure who they think their audience is going to be.
Well, he has actually interviewed the likes of Gordon Brown and Simon Cowell for ITV in the UK. He's got a very well-respected...
What's his background in tabloid journalism?
He worked for one of Rupert Murdoch's tabloids.
Well, so did I.
Was it News of the World?
Was he at The Sun?
I think it was. It was like News of the World, and it was The Sun.
That's pretty low rent, yeah.
Yeah, Daily Mirror. I mean, he's done like some pretty serious tabloid-type stuff.
What I found more interesting, at least to me, was that there was a lot of talk about how CNN botched this whole transition. And we should say that Piers Morgan is not necessarily confirmed as Larry King's replacement.
But, I thought he was.
Well, I think they're still negotiating. I know Jeff Zucker was on CNBC, and he said that Piers Morgan could do both jobs. He could continue to host America's Got Talent, and he could host this CNN talk show at 9 o'clock. But CNN began looking for a replacement for Larry King in mid-June, kind of forgetting, in a way, to tell Larry King that he might be retiring. You know, I think that a lot of people, at least in media circles, criticized CNN for the way they handled this whole transition and the way news started to leak out, and whether they were negotiating with Piers Morgan before Larry King made his announcement.
Yeah, but you know, Larry King's pretty clueless. I mean, he's old and I know it sounds mean, but I really believe this. He probably knew. He just didn't know that he knew.
Well, in June, he received some of his worst ratings ever. So a lot of people are pointing to the fact that Larry King's time might be over, at least as a talk show host.
Well, I looked him up, and Piers Morgan was editor-in-chief, I guess, of News of the World and the Mirror.
Yeah, see, there you go.
The Daily Mirror. And he is also currently, I guess, editor of First News, a national newspaper for children in the UK, which is kind of interesting.
Oh, that's real sweet.
But for me, CNN is so lost, and yet their brand is hard news. And if there's one thing that's lacking on all these 24-hour news channels, it's news. And if they would focus on doing news instead of having frickin', you know, beep that out if you want to, but having frickin' 18 people do talking heads on the news of the moment or reading tweets over the air. Oh, our reader just emailed us and said this and that about what we just said 2 minutes ago on the news. If they would do the news all day long, they would differentiate themselves from Fox and MSNBC. Instead of just having talking heads, they can do a chat show late at night. That's where Piers Morgan belongs.
Well, you know, that's what they do in other countries. In Europe, CNN Europe is just news all day long, and it's actually quite good.
Right. All you get now is commentary and analysis and talking heads. They'll do breaking news, and they'll follow that ad nauseum, you know, a kid in a balloon. But just hard news all day, every day, guess what? That's what they're known for. That was their brand originally. They've lost sight of that completely. And doing Piers Morgan a chat show at 9 p.m. at night is the last thing in the world that's going to help CNN turn their fortunes around.
Yeah, who likes talking heads anyway? I mean, who wants to hear people just mouthing off about whatever they think about? I take that back. I'm going to rewind a little bit. And well, certainly we hope you want to hear talking heads, or at least our talking heads. And you should.
I like Fear of Music.
I like Turtles.
I have no idea what you guys are talking
turtles.
About.
I was quoting a Talking Heads album. What are you talking about? The band, the Turtles.
I was quoting a YouTube clip. You guys don't know I love Turtles.
You're much better than me. Good job.
You guys don't know I love Turtles? Okay, I'm sending
No.
You.
Well, Karen, while you send an email to Michael, I will tell our listeners that next week we hope to have a few people on who have attended Comic-Con, which is the annual fan fest down in San Diego, which will be held next weekend. In the meantime, you can visit our website, showbizsandbox.com, to find links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode. That's also where you'll find links to our email address, dirt@showbizsandbox.com, and a way to leave us a voicemail. The phone number to call is 888-567-SAN. That's 888-567-7263. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by MGMT, the popular indie rock group whose latest album, as Michael pointed out, is Congratulations, and who can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz, when he's not out on assignment, apparently flying a kite, based on the sound of the wind behind him. Links to all of his entertainment news stories can be found on michaelgiltz.com, or you can follow him on Twitter. @MichaelGiltz is the username to look up. For Karen, she's also on Twitter, and her Twitter handle is @Karen_Woodward. Her website is KarenWoodwardOnline.com. My Twitter handle is @Sperling, and some of my writing can be found at CelluloidJunkie.com. Until next week.
Play nice.